is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I think there's a lot of undecidedness right now. People are scared. But in the wake of 9/11, the industry came back. You know, it took a couple of years for it to recover. And I think that's exactly what will happen to the aviation industry. We will recover.
That's Kelly Slingers, a flight instructor at the Eagle Air Flight School, on the challenges facing the airline industry as it recovers from the impact of COVID-19. Details coming up also. The water situation in Zimbabwe's second largest city, Bulawayo, is getting worse by the day. And a top virus expert in South Africa says the COVID-19 death toll in the country may be twice as high from the official figures. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Africa's network of airlines could take up to 3 years to rebound from the devastating impact of coronavirus-related travel restrictions, says industry insiders. But this global crisis has also allowed the battered industry to rethink and plan for a new, different way of doing things. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Africa's airlines have been grounded for months as nations have shut their borders to try to stop the spread of coronavirus. Now, as countries prepare to reopen their skies, the industry is trying to figure out how to meet the challenge. Late Wednesday, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa announced his country, a travel hub for the continent, would begin to allow international flights again.
One of the earliest measures we took to contain the spread of the virus was to severely restrict international arrivals and to close our borders. With a move to alert level 1, we will gradually and cautiously ease restrictions on international travel. We will be allowing travel into and out of South Africa for business, leisure, and other travel with effect from the 1st of October 2020.
He added that the government would restrict travel to and from certain countries that have high infection rates. That list of allowed and restricted countries has yet to be published. For the airline industry, this is not a simple matter of picking up where they left off, experts say. Since March, the livelihoods of 3.3 million workers, not just pilots, but engineers, mechanics, and support staff, have hung in the balance as African airlines saw their income shrivel and their future grow increasingly uncertain. Chris Swiegenthal, CEO of the Airlines Association of Southern Africa, painted a grim picture. He spoke to VOA over Google Hangouts.
By the middle of April, you had scheduled air traffic down at 95% below what was the February 2020 levels. So the airlines had to go into a cash preservation system where they had to obviously conserve cash and look at ways of reducing costs. And one of the major areas where they obviously looked at reducing costs was in the area of, unfortunately, their employees.
Pilot Carl Bolwech knows that firsthand. Right before South Africa announced its national lockdown, the veteran pilot flew his last flight for South African Airways domestic service. At 58, he says, he's made peace with the fact that his long career ended that day, with a whimper.
It was on the 15th of March. Yeah, so, yeah, actually, I didn't know that it would have been my last flight.
And where did you go?
Oh, I can't remember now. I was hoping you wouldn't ask that question. I think it was... I'll have to check in my logbook.
However, Swiegenthal says, this could be a chance for the industry to make much-needed, beneficial changes. Some airlines, he says, like continental leader Ethiopian Airlines, have converted passenger planes into cargo aircraft to meet the continent's continuing demand for cargo because of a lack of ground transportation infrastructure. Across the industry, he says, airlines are looking at how to build a diverse workforce. And, he says, in coming months, passengers should expect to be courted by airlines as they try to win them back.
There's got to be a lot of marketing and convincing of the passengers that it is safe to fly and healthy to fly. And obviously, from that perspective, you will see initially quite a lot of low fares in the market. And we've seen that in the low fares in the market. And then as more people start to fly, you may probably see the some of the fares climb.
He predicts that in South Africa, domestic travel will rebound by mid-2021. International travel will take longer, until 2023 or even 2024. Waiting in the wings, though, is a new, hopeful group of staff. 28-year-old flight instructor Kelly Slingers predicts there will be a rise in charter travel in Africa. She says she's seeing a lot of laid-off commercial pilots come through seeking to be trained as instructors.
I think we are a very adaptable industry. If you look at 9/11, you know, I think there's a lot of undecidedness right now. People are scared. But in the wake of 9/11, the industry came back. You know, it took a couple of years for it to recover. And I think that's exactly what will happen to the aviation industry. We will recover.
And when it does, she says, the sky is the limit. Anita Pell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Reuters reported today that the South African government has told administrators of South African Airways, which was struggling financially even before COVID-19, that there is a clear cabinet commitment to provide the state airline with $650.7 million to help it keep flying. One of South Africa's top virus experts says the COVID-19 death toll may be almost twice as high as the official figure because thousands of fatalities have been attributed to other causes. And it could be even higher. The latest government total stands at almost 16,000, already making South Africa the country hardest hit by the COVID-19 on the continent. Darren Taylor reports.
Professor Shabir Mahdi, a medical scientist and presidential advisor, isn't suggesting that the government's covering up the true extent of COVID-19. But he says in a country like South Africa, which doesn't have the resources of wealthier nations, it's impossible to register all infections and deaths that happen during a pandemic.
Not everyone that has died has been investigated for COVID. And in many instances, those deaths that have occurred have not been reported as COVID-19. And we also need to appreciate that many people possibly didn't even come to healthcare facilities and actually chose to be managed possibly at home. And those deaths might have actually occurred outside of healthcare facilities.
Mahdi has measured mortality rates in all 9 provinces since the pandemic began in March. He's come up with a death toll that he believes is closer to the truth.
Right now, where we're sitting possibly, is that there's been roughly about 30,000 people that have died from COVID-19 in South Africa, and that is just using the...
The country's Medical Research Council has counted all death certificates filed during the pandemic. Based on this, health activist Mark Haywood says the COVID-19 death toll in South Africa is probably higher than Mahdi's estimate.
The Medical Research Council documents 42,396 deaths above the average between the 6th of May and the 1st of September this year. And in their report, they say that a significant portion of the current excess mortality being observed in South Africa is likely to be attributable to COVID-19.
Despite the thousands who've died, Mahdi points out that South Africa's done much better than expected in managing the outbreak. He says infections, hospitalizations, and deaths continue to decline. But Mahdi expects these to pick up again in the coming weeks, now that the government's eased lockdown restrictions and is allowing international travel.
When we see that resurgence, in all likelihood, it is going to be less severe than what we experienced this time around, which itself was probably less severe than what was predicted by most people.
He says it's also possible that a significant portion of people who've already had COVID-19 may be reinfected during a second wave. Again, the scientist isn't overly concerned about this.
Reinfections would occur, but when reinfections occur, in all likelihood, the second episode of infection would actually be less severe than the first episode. In addition to which, when reinfected, you probably would be less infectious because your body is now able to mount an immune response much sooner and get rid of the virus much quicker.
Mahdi's busy managing the South African leg of the Oxford University trial to find a vaccine against COVID-19. His team has enrolled just over 1,800 participants, all invaluable to the search for the medicine that would end the pandemic. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Egypt's rapid urban encroachment has gone unchecked for decades, but it has become the top national issue after President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi threatened to quit if it's not efficiently handled, surprising many in the nation of 100 million. Prime Minister Mustafa Madabouli says at least 70% of all construction since 1985 is illegal. Offenders have been given until the end of the month to apply for settlements that will compensate the state for legalizing unlawful buildings. The government has, in quick succession this summer, raised electricity rates, hiked fares on the Cairo metro that millions use daily, and shrunk the size of the state-subsidized bread that is the main staple for most people. Sayed Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the University in Cairo, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi about the impact of these developments on the average Egyptian.
Egyptians live on only 7% of their territory due to shortage of water. So loss of arable land is surely irreparable. But there are two aims here by this government. One is to deal with the economic impact of COVID-19 after losing significant sources of income, revenue, workers, remittances, falling oil prices, Suez Canal revenue, in addition to the shortage of the usual Gulf aid that used to come and help the government. So the government has no other option but seek additional sources domestically by funding from overtaxing the population or searching all corruption files to get more money. We have seen this before in chasing Mubarak old guards' deep pockets. This is not the issue. The issue is to get money, as we have seen, for example, in the trial and conviction of the former Minister of Information, Safwat Shreef. Similarly, it is widely known that the construction sector in Egypt leads the Egyptian economy in general and is full of corruption since a long time ago. So they began targeting it without taking into consideration the powerful government officials sanctioned in the first place this corruption and left the burden of paying the price on citizens. Understandable that the government is in a crisis. So too are its citizens. They are also in a crisis.
This summer alone, the Egyptian government has, in quick succession, raised electricity charges, kicked fares on Cairo Metro, and reduced the size of state-subsidized bread that is the main staple for the majority of Egyptians. Did that governmental tendency of burdening the middle class and the poor raise questions in Egypt about the government spending priorities?
Well, these measures were part of the agreement with IMF, plus the economic impact of COVID-19. No country in the world today is immune from the economic impact, including Egypt. And that's why all these measures, unfortunately, took place at the same time, because now we are reaping the impact of COVID-19. So this is what is happening, and that's how things are developing. And of course, it is leading to political instability in many countries.
Concerned over growing popular discontent, the Egyptian Prime Minister has dismissed accusations that seeking financial settlements from the owners of illegal buildings was in reality an attempt by his government to lay its hands on more money from the Egyptian pockets. He says legalizing the buildings will significantly increase their value and allow owners to sell them at a profit. What's your take on this explanation?
This would be fair if all parties involved in the urban corruption and misplanning get also punished. We are only punishing citizens who had no other option but paid bribes demanded by local government officials to get the construction permits. It would be better make urban planning from the beginning in the new established cities. As for older cities like Cairo, like Alexandria, like other places, a long-term taxing should be taken into consideration. And you have to also take into consideration the economic impact of COVID-19 on the economic welfare of citizens. A house is the most basic need for any human being.
And this cannot be handled in a cold, new liberal capitalist way without taking into consideration the social impacts on citizens. Long established corruption practices in the country over decades cannot be solved by a jot of a pen in a few weeks. The diagnosis is correct, but the treatment is harsh and unacceptable, and it will cause trouble because millions of people who had done this because this was the corruption from the local government officials. You cannot treat it just like that in a few months when everybody's pocket are not as deep as it used to be because of the economic condition.
That was Said Sadek, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Zimbabwe is making frantic moves to reopen its economy after COVID-19 lockdowns further strained the battered economy. Getting students back in school is a key issue, but teachers are saying they won't return because they can't afford it. Reporter Kuzaza Nwashi has more from Harare.
Annual student exams are scheduled to begin on the 28th. Teachers say they don't see that happening unless their demands are met. Neshin Mudzitirwa is spokesperson for the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe.
The COVID-19 pandemic further incapacitated the teachers because of the COVID-19 government regulations that were restricting the movement of people and operating of some businesses. Majority of teachers were just logged in their homes. They were not even able to do some part-time jobs to supplement their little end income. The standard of living is further worsened.
He adds, because of this and a long-standing issue on remuneration, he does not foresee schools reopening.
The salary dispute between the government and the teachers has not yet been resolved, so we are not going to report for work on the 20th of September. We will only report for work if the government restores back a teacher salary of $520 per month.
He adds that $520 is the amount teachers earned in 2018 when Zimbabwe primarily used the US dollar. Today, they earn a local currency equivalent to just $30. Salary dispute aside, Edgar Gweshe, a parent of two, worries about student preparedness for the crucial tests.
They are not ready for these exams after having stayed for so long without access to educational material and without going for proper classes. They cannot be ready this time, but maybe it could be a case of a privileged few who had access to online courses, but the majority, I don't think they are ready.
Schools have been closed for over 6 months. While everyone is eager to see normalcy, critics say the return must be gradual. The Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe wrote to government through the Minister of Public Service that they will not be able to report for duty. Recently, civil servants turned down a 40% pay rise in the local currency. They want to be paid in US dollars, which is more stable. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashe from Harare.
Thieves broke into Gambia's tax administration building, but while they likely found little cash, they made off with something potentially much more valuable, a computer loaded with taxpayers' private information. Panderambai reports for VOA from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yankuba Dabo, the Director General of the Gambia Revenue Authority, says the database containing information of Gambian taxpayers is now in the hands of the thieves. They now have the software the agency uses for tax records, as well as information relating to taxpayers. GRA management waited a week before answering questions about the theft, and then not until an online newspaper broke the story on Thursday. Speaking via Skype, Dabo says the matter has been reported to the police and all efforts have been made to track down the thieves.
Well, our wish is that we get back our computer. That is our wish. But if in events, then we don't have it, we just have to get another computer and install the software. Because the software is just going to help you to monitor what is the activities that are going as far as the system is concerned.
Dabo said officials with the Police Intervention Unit, PIU, and the GRA security guards were on duty when the incident happened. And he says it appears the thieves were not related to the GRA.
Basically, they came through the window and the door was locked. And then within the office space, we also discovered that there is a knife they left and the whole place was stained with blood. So we don't know how that blood happened, whether maybe when they were coming through the window, they hurt themselves or whatever happened. But we discover a bag was left there as well, plus a knife with a blood stain in the on the furniture.
Dabo and his colleagues have been interviewed by the police. He thinks it likely the thieves did not get what they hoped for.
Maybe those who are trying to break GRA's office, they may be looking for money. They are attacking the wrong place. Because on this day and age, we will not use our offices, you know, to keep the revenue money here. Like I said, we have an MOU with a lot of banks, commercial banks that are here. And all these, most of these banks have their offices inside GRA here. So when the moment the payments happen, they collect these monies and then they don't even sleep, spend the night here.
Police spokesman Superintendent Lamingjai says the investigation into the matter is in high gear. No arrests have been made yet. For VOA News, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Nigeria's Supreme Court in late August upheld the right of female children to inherit property from their fathers, a ruling that has shaken traditional male-only inheritance practiced by several ethnic groups like the Igbo. While rights activists celebrate the ruling as an advance for equality between the sexes, some critics say the Supreme Court is undermining traditions and customs. Timothy Obiezu has the report from Abuja.
Kiruka Ani is from a polygamous family in southeastern Nigeria. Her mother is the second of three wives, and her only brother and heir to family property died early this year. In March, she and her mother were excluded from her family's assets during a sharing process that followed Igbo customs forbidding women from family inheritance. Rolling up bowls of locust bean for the market, Annie says she's trying to pick up the pieces of her life.
I believe that we all humans, anything that they give to male ones, they should give also to the female ones. Nobody, as in, we are equal. But I don't know their own mentality. Maybe the female are not, they are not, I don't understand.
The age-long practice that disinherits women is based on the idea that a female child will someday get married and leave her home to live with her new family. Over the years, many women like Annie have been denied money and property as a result. But late last month, Nigeria's Supreme Court, in a landmark judgment, annulled the tradition and called it discriminatory and contradictory to the nation's constitution. Nigerian gender equality advocate Solomon Buchi celebrated the decision.
Constantly, we culture on the scale of objectivity, on the scale of fairness, on the scale of justice, on the scale of equality and equity. Is it fair to people? Is it just to people? Is it equitable? Is it compassionate? We don't want to call it our culture, or we are not going to pride in a culture that dehumanizes.
Others object. Abuja residents Eluchuku and Chikwadi believe the traditional way of doing things has served people well.
Properties should be shared among men, because that has been something our forefathers has been doing for so long, and it has been working. It has been working like that, and I don't think our women are complaining.
It's left for the boy child now to consider the girls and give them some.
Even so, the chairman of the Abuja Council of Igbo Traditional Rulers, Ezudo Uche Egenti, wants other monarchs to support the Supreme Court judgment.
The Supreme Court has spoken. It is proper for you and I to go by the laws of the land. And I wonder why it's just on Igbo land. You understand? Which means the North, the South, they are not practicing the same thing we are practicing.
While some predict implementing and enforcing the court's ruling will be difficult, gender equality advocates say they will be observing the progress. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abbaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.